the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got the next installment for Lightning Month. I've got an interview with Nick Carter and Pierre Rochard discussing the economics of Lightning. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So, BlockFi, and if you've been listening to the podcast over the last few weeks, you will have seen that I've been offering you the chance to submit any questions you've got to their CEO, Zach Prince, regarding their new interest accounts. So I did receive a whole bunch of emails. So thank you for that. And today I collected up those questions. I got on the phone with Zach. We recorded it and it's now live for you to listen to. So if you want to have a listen to this, if you've got some questions that you think he might answer for you as well, just head over to my SoundCloud page, which is soundcloud.com/what-bitcoin-did, and you'll find it there. Also, let me know what you think, or if you've got any further questions, it'd be great to hear from you on that. But if you are interested in finding out more about BlockFi's interest accounts, then head over to their website, which is blockfi.com, which is blockfi.com, and you can find out more there. Okay, so on to my interview with Nick and Pierre. And now that I've started to have a bit of a play with the Lightning Network, and also following some of my interviews I've already conducted, and then following some discussions online and people getting in touch with me, I'm starting to have questions and thoughts regarding Lightning, but also the relationship between Lightning and the base chain. So some of these questions come down to user experience, the experience of moving between Lightning and the base chain, and some of it is regarding the economics of it all. And one thing that I've been wrestling with is the relationship between the base chain and Lightning as adoption grows, and are there any risk that higher fees on the base chain will make it unaffordable for most people? And therefore, is this fine? You know, is this the only way to scale something like Bitcoin? If the majority of people are pushed onto the second layer, will they be offered the same security and experience as the base chain? Or does this mean we have a two-tier Bitcoin? So something I've been wrestling with, and definitely Nick and Pierre were probably the two perfect people to get on the phone and discuss this with. They're two people I really respect and who have a really good grasp of the economics of Bitcoin. Pierre probably a bit more with Lightning, maybe Nick a bit more with the base chain. Maybe they would both say differently from that, but definitely two people was worth discussing with. And I definitely came out the interview with a different perspective. So I hope this is useful to you. Have a listen. As you know, if you've got any questions, get in touch. Let me know what you think. And also, if you enjoy the show and you want to support it, just head over to my website. There's a section there. Just go to whatbitcoindid.com, click on support. That'll explain everything you can do to help, even if you just leave me a review on iTunes. It's all super helpful. Okay, so if you've got any questions about the interview, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi, Nick. Hi, Pierre. How are you both doing?
Hi, Peter. Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, Peter. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thank you both for coming on. Obviously, second time for you both. As you're aware, I'm doing a Lightning month, learning everything I can about Lightning. And one of the things I did was I tried to keep away from Lightning quite a bit before I knew I was going to do this, because I wanted to approach everything fresh. Now I've been looking at it, I've got so many different questions, so many things I want to explore. I don't know if my questions are dumb or fair, but I think we'll find a way through it through this session. So we'll just roll with my questions and see where we come out. A good place to start with is one of the things that I'm trying to understand is the difference between the Bitcoin base chain and Lightning, and whether we're going to get to a stage where we have a two-tier Bitcoin, where the base chain is only for those who can afford it and Lightning is for everyone else. Any thoughts on that, Nick?
Yeah, that is a very good question. I don't view them as distinct. I mean, I see Lightning as essentially just encumbered Bitcoin with certain conditions required for its release. So, you know, conceptually to me, you know, Lightning is really just a name for an elaborate system of smart contracts, which mediate what you can do with your Bitcoins. And it's a arrangement that people enter into consensually so that they can unlock some additional usage out of Bitcoin. And I think actually I'm not an expert on this, but the direction that things seem to be going is to further blur the lines between Lightning or Bitcoin held in Lightning and Bitcoin itself. And, you know, this notion of a bifurcation seems strange to me, because in my opinion, for Lightning to work, you need to have sort of periodic closings and settlements to the main chain. So if the main chain for some reason gets stupendously expensive to use, my guess would be that that cost is inherited on top. I don't think that's likely. I mean, you know, no one has ever really worked out what the sort of required level of fees is, but it doesn't look likely to me at all that we're going to be in a really high fee regime anytime soon. So it's not necessarily something I'm too worried about.
Like long term, I think that every single Bitcoin will be on Lightning, quote unquote. Like I don't think that anyone will be using the base chain except for closing a channel and simultaneously opening another one. I don't think like the whales will be, you know, sending on-chain transactions instead of sending off-chain, because I think that if we think about Bitcoin versus Lightning or on-chain versus off-chain, we're thinking about a set of trade-offs, and the most important trade-off is that you have to be online for Lightning, whereas with on-chain Bitcoin, you could be offline for, you know, forever and not have it be a problem. But I think that, sadly, perhaps, our society frowns upon people being offline for any reason, not just Lightning. So, I don't think any of us are, like, going on long Appalachian hikes for months at a time and thus being offline for long enough where this would be a problem. So I think that everyone's online all the time, and so that trade-off is perfectly acceptable. And then the other trade-off is the hot wallet situation. And I think that the technology around this is going to continue to improve over the coming years, where essentially we'll no longer worry about cold storage. Like, I think that people will be completely okay with hot wallets, and they'll be secure, and like the security problems won't be around, you know, the software or the hardware getting hacked. It'll be about people getting socially engineered into sending their Bitcoin. So I think that eventually all Bitcoin will be on Lightning, and no one will go out of their way to use the base chain, because it's just a worse system than off-chain.
I might push back on that actually a little bit. I think, you know, I broadly agree with the thrust of what you're saying, but base layer Bitcoin still has pretty attractive properties. And, you know, let's say you're like a political dissident and you're in jail for 5 years, you know, and you have a brain wallet, and you posted the, you know, the QR code before you went to jail. I think you should still be able to collect, you know, donations in that time, even though you're totally offline. That's just one like simple case where I think base layer Bitcoin is still kind of preferable.
I think obviously though, we're a long way from being at a stage where all transactions are done through Lightning and the base chain is just for opening and closing channels. So we're obviously a long way away from that. One of the things I'm trying to get my head around with this is that I'm trying to understand the different trade-offs, because there's a few things that have kind of come together for me at the same time I'm trying to figure out. So the security of the Bitcoin network is reliant upon miners, and often the discussion comes up about what happens as the miner rewards drop. We're going to require a fee, you know, a fee network. So if we require higher fees, therefore the base chain is going to have limitations to who actually uses it. I'm getting kind of lost in this circle now, where people are saying we don't need to talk about the fee network because this is years away for the mining rewards to drop so far. Yet at the same time, there will be implications later on. Can you see where I'm kind of getting lost in this circle?
Yeah, it's tricky, because the problem with very openly discussing potential shortcomings that you're worried about is that they can then get magnified by people who might be operating in less than good faith, who are looking for the most compelling attack vectors against Bitcoin to promote their own scheme, for instance. So I would say that is part of the reason why discussion of potential issues is not as open as it might be otherwise. You know, that said, there is definitely a school of thought within Bitcoin land that actually this isn't a problem, and that even as the subsidy goes away, you know, maybe the absolute properties will change a little bit, but it's not as much of an existential threat. So there's still a debate on whether it's actually, you know, a serious long-term threat or not. I'm sure Pierre has thoughts on that too.
Yeah, so I do think that it is a long-term threat. I think the way that we think about it today is just, it's like going back in the 1920s and looking through a book about the future. Like, oh, there's going to be flying cars like the Jetsons, or, you know, like, and we try to project out what it's going to be like in 30 years. But then in 30 years, there's going to be some similarities. You know, we're going to make some calls, right? But for the most part, our expectations about the future are completely unrealistic compared to like what actually happens. So we just have to focus on what's within our control today, rather than trying to figure out a solution to something in 30 years. And the way I see it is that basically we have to maximize the productivity of block space. And that's what's going to make it so that people are going to pay high enough fees where we can avoid having to, you know, have a tail emission or, you know, long-term inflation or whatever people want to call it. But the other thing too is that, like, people, when they're discussing this topic, like, they'll use the word security, which implies that if there's not enough security, then the system fails on a global basis. Whereas really what we're talking about is probabilistic transaction finality, where if a given person has an insufficient amount of finality, that actually doesn't cause the system globally to fail. It might mean that they get double spent on locally. And so what we've seen is that a local failure like that, and it happened with Ethereum Classic recently, but I mean, these things, like, you know, people say, oh, well, that's not the same or whatever. But I really think the economics are and the logic of it is pretty clear, which is that it's only the person who got double spent on that, quote unquote, loses faith in the system. But really, they're just going to wait for more confirmations. And to me, that's like the other solution to the block subsidy going away is just, all right, well, instead of waiting for that rule of thumb of six confirmations, now we wait for 60 or 600, and that it's not, or 6,000. Like, even that's not a huge problem for people who aren't, you know, ordering Boeing 747s from China.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I would say it's very much, it would be extremely fruitful for some of the more, you know, mathematical and theory minded people in the industry to revisit that six confirmation rule of thumb and determine or devise a dynamic model for confirmations, or just maybe a more justifiable, the six confirmation kind of rule of thumb comes from almost a throwaway comment Satoshi made at one point. You know, I think there's other variables that come into play there, including the size of the transaction you're accepting, what has happened recently with hash rate, and whether you have a non-repurposable hardware on your chain, whether there's a big secondary market for that hardware. You know, in my opinion, there are many more factors that are highly salient there.
And the factors you just listed are just the endogenous factors to the chain. If you look at the exogenous factor of, like, who is it sending this transaction? Do you have legal recourse if they do defraud you by doing a double spend? In which case, like, that kind of obviates a lot of endogenous concerns.
That's true, but I don't know if we want to make Bitcoin security model dependent institutions.
I do think that the local we're talking about local transaction finality, not Bitcoin's like global, you know, trustlessness properties. And so in that regard, it's always going to be the case that there's other concerns than just the like on-chain situation.
Yeah, I would say it is, you know, it's contextual. And if you have other information, why not use that to build a pattern of evidence, which then plays into the amount of confirmations you're willing to accept. The other thing I'll say on this point broadly is that it's really weird to me that people, when they model out Bitcoin's like long-term security, et cetera, or you know, security budget, and then use that to guess at what fees are going to be, they just take today's security expenditure and model all their assumptions on that. Like, what would it take to extend today's security budget into the indefinite future? To me, that's totally crazy, because the security budget today is just a function of the issuance and the price. And, you know, the price is completely contingent Nobody has any control over that. So it could be that we're vastly overpaying for security. We just don't know, or underpaying. That seems unlikely to me.
Yeah, I would argue that we're overpaying considering how we don't have any double spends. And so, like, to me, underpaying would be double spends are just so pervasive that it's making the chain unusable, or, you know, getting close to that is unacceptable. But then having zero double spends, to me, that's an indication of overpaying, and that it wouldn't be the end of the world if we had a few a year.
But yeah, totally agreed. It to me, it's pretty, well, staggering, actually, that Bitcoin has never had a real confirmed double spend, as far as I can tell. You know, a malicious exploit, even though there have been issues with the chain in the past. So it would be indicative of the fact that we might actually be overpaying.
So one of the things I try and do is, rather than predict what will be with on-chain fees, is try and imagine what the implication of higher fees are. So I've seen recently that the number of on-chain transactions is going up and up and up. You know, we have the potential that through another bull market and the growth of the technology and the use cases and the growth of the Lightning Network, that that will continue to increase. And perhaps on-chain fees may be $10, $20, you know, whatever they are. A couple of notes that came back to me was, one person said that $60 fee is a good price to pay for a transaction on a secure immutable ledger. And then there was another comment from Giacomo where he said, yes, valuable things are scarce. So there's almost a defense, therefore, of high on-chain fees. But what I'm trying to understand is, what is the implication for people who maybe want to get involved in Bitcoin, or they aren't Bitcoin rich? Does that mean they are therefore excluded from the base chain and the majority of their experience is on Lightning and Lightning only?
Yeah, I mean, just mathematically, right? Like, if someone wants to buy $20 worth of Bitcoin and the on-chain transaction fee to send it to their wallet is $10, like, that's just an unrealistic situation where they would just go use Lightning instead. And so it's on us to make sure that Lightning is usable for that.
Yeah, I think something people miss is the fact that you can onboard directly into Lightning. You know, you can create in the near future, you will be able to, with many exchanges and Bitcoin banks, so to speak. So, you know, I happen to know that there are many active projects working on that. So you won't have to onboard into base layer Bitcoin and then do a cumbersome transition to Lightning. It'll just be much more seamless. So, of course, transacting on Lightning is not free, because you do depend on the ability to exit to the base layer, potentially. But the other thing I'll say is that, you know, in my opinion, fees are never low or high. They just are a certain amount. The system is this emergent dynamic system, and it outputs a certain level of fees in Satoshi terms. The reason people really think fees were super, super high in late 2017 was because the unit price was high. So it was high in dollar terms. But if you look at the spikes in, like, sats per byte, you know, in terms of the system that doesn't know what the price is in dollars, three of those spikes, like, we had a spike in June 2017 that was about as high as the spike in November. So the reason people really focus on the $50, $60 fees is because that was when the unit price was $19,000. So yeah, I would say that's kind of a distraction. People index it to that, which doesn't make sense. Everyone's been complaining about the high fees recently. If you actually look at the chart of fees, they're still minuscule. And, you know, it's just ridiculous that, you know, a scarce spot on the world's most secure ledger can be yours for about a dollar right now, or less. I mean, much less in practice. So I don't think fees are ever low or high. It's just a function of your expectations. And if your expectations are miscalibrated, that's almost, you know, your fault.
Yeah. And a bigger problem, really, in my mind, is the volatility of fees. So trying to have a good fee estimation so that you're not overpaying or underpaying, and the experience around that has been a bigger issue than the absolute level of fees.
Yeah, totally true. And it's because fee estimation is like a three-body problem. It kind of reminds me of trading. It's like, you're not necessarily trading against some pure piece of information. You're trading against the expectations of all your other fellow traders. So when you're estimating fees, you can look at historically, you know, what typical fee to enter next block should be at this level of usage, and you can build those kinds of models. But everyone else is also looking at the same fee estimator. So you almost want to outbid what someone else looking at the same estimator would be bidding. So you have these weird situations with kind of feedback loops in the fee estimators. I think poorly calibrated fee estimators were kind of a cause of the crisis. You can always look back at historical, you know, sats per byte in previous blocks and see that people were way overspending for fees.
Yeah, what I'd really like to see develop is a futures market for on-chain transaction fees, so that if you open a channel today and you say, okay, I want to lock in a certain sats per byte in 6 months when I'm going to close this channel, then I can enter into a futures contract to fix that so that now the volatility doesn't affect me.
Do you not think charging fees on sats per byte is a bit too confusing for most people?
Yeah, for normal users, yeah. But it should be up to the wallet providers to be sensible about it and to kind of abstract that away a little bit.
We've seen wallets create UIs where basically they say like low, medium, high priority. So there's ways of communicating what the underlying system is doing to the end user. But I also think that there's room for user education as well. So if we're able to learn this stuff, then I think a lot of other people will as well. But yeah, for mainstream consumers, the wallet really should be taking care of that.
Say I have $100 of Bitcoin, and to me, that's a lot of money where I am. I've got it on the base chain, but you know, over time, the fees are going up on the base chain. So will I potentially have to make a consideration of moving that all onto Lightning so that I don't end up losing most of it in on-chain fees?
Yeah. Well, it kind of depends on what end you're holding those coins. So I think that Bitcoin's on-chain transaction fees are going to continue to be volatile and evolve. And it's not clear to me that like it's going to be a steady linear trend up or an exponential trend up or like sideways. Like I have no way of knowing where it's going to go. So if someone says, well, I'm going to be holding these Bitcoin for like several years, then they can wait for an opportunity to move those coins at a very low transaction fee. But if they're going to be sending it, you know, within the next few days, then and on-chain fees are going up, then yeah, there's a sense of urgency to actually getting those coins onto Lightning. But the other part of the equation too is that we don't know what future protocol changes will allow from the perspective of essentially like what you're describing is someone being concerned about their on-chain funds becoming below the dust limit, sort of like where it costs more to move them than the value of.
Or even just moving part of it will chew up such a high percentage of their Bitcoin because of the fees.
Right. So there may be protocol changes in the future where like the cost of moving those Bitcoin goes down a lot. So we have like Schnorr signature aggregation on the horizon. Then there's everything that we don't know that we don't know yet. And that might mean that it's not a problem. But generally speaking, yeah, I think that people should be thinking about opportunities to get onto Lightning and to consolidate their outputs on chain.
Yeah, I would echo what Pierre said. I mean, the development trend in Bitcoin seems to be towards more parsimonious usages of block space, with Schnorr being a great example. And, you know, just the mere adoption of SegWit really moves the needle a lot. So SegWit gave us a 2.5, 3x increase if people actually use SegWit a lot in block space. So really big efficiency increase. I mean, it was an effective block size increase, right? And the effect of that is very stark. So if you look back to the, right now we're at a period of very high utilization of block space. It's almost the highest it's ever been, in fact. If you look back to the last time block space was, you know, this much data was throughputting, you know, through the Bitcoin system, it was between about December and February. So December 2017 to February 2018. Fees were never below $5 back then. And now fees, you know, on a weekly basis are about $1. So we've already seen an increase in capacity, and the next set of innovations, they're going to be an increase in density. So there is considerably more slack built into the system now. It can tolerate a lot more usage. And there's more education too. Back then, a lot of the big power users of Bitcoin, the exchanges, were not batching. They weren't using SegWit. They were being extremely wasteful with block space. So things are really different now. And everyone is kind of shell-shocked by, you know, what happened in late 2017. But conditions are really different now. So I really don't expect fees to climb anytime soon.
So really, it's just a case of putting the trust in the future technologies, optimizing the use of block space, and at the same time, in parallel, Lightning improving and having a better experience for people just to live entirely on Lightning.
And just to finish up, I would say calibrating expectations. You know, if you want a spot on base layer Bitcoin, it's probably going to be a couple bucks, you know, would be my guess. If fees are basically zero, then you do run into those instability problems the Princeton Naranian paper goes into. So I think if you want to have your cake and eat it too, you know, you want zero fees, but you want long-term security and you want scarcity, you're probably not going to get that.
Yeah. And then conceptually, kind of the way to think about on-chain versus off-chain is that on-chain, you're paying by the amount of data that you're consuming. And so there you can move hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin with, you know, a $2. Whereas off-chain, you're paying by the amount of value that you're moving because you're exhausting channel capacity in one direction or another. And so there, it you can move $20 worth of Bitcoin for a fraction of a penny. But if you're trying to move $600 worth of Bitcoin, then it can become like very expensive, where to the point where it's less expensive to move it on-chain instead. So there's kind of a trade-off.
Just to butt in there, I just listened to your podcast with Christian Decker, and this is why it really resonated with me. He calls Lightning complementary to Bitcoin. They are priced in different ways. Lightning is great for small to medium-sized payments. It's priced on basically on a bandwidth basis. And Bitcoin is great for really colossal transactions, which maybe you can wait a little bit longer to settle. So they work extremely well together.
Next up, I talked to Pierre and Nick more about the economics of the Lightning Network, but before that, I got a message from my show sponsors. So Kraken, I'm now an active user of the platform. I mentioned previously that at the end of each month with the podcast, I have to balance my accounts. I have to buy some Bitcoin sometimes to pay people for things they do to help me deliver the podcast, and I also have to cash in some of the things I'm paid in Bitcoin as well just to pay my bills. I previously submitted my KYC. I was approved up to their level 3 in under 2 hours, which was super cool. And yeah, a few days ago, I used the platform for the first time for buying and selling Bitcoin. So my honest assessment, because you wouldn't expect anything else from me, right? Okay, so firstly, everything was super easy. I transferred my Bitcoin to Kraken, market sold, and withdrew direct to my bank account, and the money was there, I think within a few hours. I didn't actually monitor this because I didn't know how long it would take. I didn't think of monitoring it, but when I went to my bank account, I think it was a few hours later, the money was there. So that was pretty cool. That was pretty quick, reassuring that I can exit from Bitcoin into fiat very, very quickly. I also then bought some Bitcoin. I was able to transfer it to a wallet, you know, almost seamlessly. Now, for me, the design isn't perfect. There are parts of the experience that could definitely be improved, but I'm going to be patient with this because I've spoken to the team and I know there's stuff being worked on here. I can't give you any kind of schedule, but I know this is a big thing that they're going to be working on. And do you know what? I didn't actually have any problems using the platform for what I wanted it to. And with everything Kraken are doing, especially all the investment in security, yeah, there's no other exchange for me. I'm really proud to be working with them. I'm really glad I've got them now as a partner, someone I can trust to work with. So yeah, if you want to check it out, if you want to become part of Kraken, head over to kraken.com, which is kraken.com. And also with BlockFi, and again, just as a reminder, over the last few weeks, I've been asking for people to submit questions regarding their new interest accounts for their CEO, Zach Prince. He agreed to come on the podcast with an open floor to answer any questions that you wanted for him. And I received a bunch of emails over the past few weeks with all these different questions. So yes, I got on the phone with Zach today. We've recorded it. It's up now on my SoundCloud page. So if you want to go and check that out, head over to soundcloud.com/what-bitcoin-did, and you'll find it there. Let me know what you think. Let me know if you've got any more questions. And if you are interested in BlockFi's interest accounts, then I suggest you head over to their website, which is blockfi.com, which is blockfi.com. See, one of the things that Christian talked about, which I'm just slightly trying to get my head around, is splicing, where he talks about the wallet. When you choose to make a payment, it will it will figure out which is the best, whether it will be best to be on chain or off chain. How much do you understand about splicing, Pierre, and how much can you add to this?
I definitely don't understand any more than I understand a lot less than Christian Decker understands. But conceptually, it makes sense to me that you could add capacity to a channel with just one on-chain transaction instead of having to close the channel and then open a new, bigger one.
So let's talk a little bit about Lightning as well. When I interviewed Jack Mallers, he talked about he sees a scenario where there's going to be plenty of people who will use Lightning and Lightning only and never touch the base chain. They will have a Lightning wallet, they will buy some Satoshis and use them, etc. And anyway, they want, but they will stay entirely on Lightning and never come off that. One of the things I didn't understand about that is, does that mean there will be channels that will never close? And then secondly, as I've moved Bitcoin onto Lightning myself, my Satoshis in my Lightning wallet are represented by my Bitcoin, which are held on the base chain, which are opened up with the multisig. Who owns those Bitcoin for the person who's bought the Satoshis? Do you understand the question?
Yeah, you do. You still own the Bitcoin. You know, the metaphor I use is when we're using the legal system and we have contracts, we don't go to court every time we rely on a contract. We only go to court when we have a dispute on the contract. And so it's still the case that we have a contract, even if we don't go to court and legally prove it. And that's kind of the way I think about off-chain, is that we don't go back on-chain unless there's a dispute. Or in the case of Lightning, like you need to close the channel because you need to open up liquidity in a different direction. But the idea being that you still have a perfectly valid Bitcoin transaction that you're sitting on. So you still own all those Bitcoin. It just hasn't been broadcast to the network.
But am I essentially buying that Bitcoin off an exchange then, but I only have it represented as Satoshis? Or is there some part of a multi-sig contract that represents that part of that Bitcoin I own?
Well, both. So when you're, let's say you were to go use an exchange and you're buying on Lightning, you're buying Bitcoins on Lightning or using Lightning, receiving them with a Lightning wallet. So they would open a channel with your Lightning wallet where they have outbound capacity and you just have inbound capacity. And then at that point, they would send over Satoshis to you. Now, that transaction or that kind of flow of payments is the same in any kind of situation, you know, if you just leave out the exchange. So it is the case that you are updating valid Bitcoin transactions every time that you update a channel, a channel's balances. So you definitely still like have an on-chain transaction that you could broadcast to the network if you wanted to.
Yeah, another way of putting it would be that if you buy Lightning from an exchange, you buy the option to transact base layer Bitcoin.
Okay, so am I at any risk that channel gets closed by somebody and therefore my Satoshis on Lightning therefore become a Bitcoin base chain transaction?
Yes, absolutely. And there we kind of run into some of the issues with what's being developed is called Autopilot, which allows for automatic management of channels. So a channel could hypothetically be open forever. Like there's nothing about it that makes it so that like it expires after a certain amount of time. So ideally, all channels would just stay open forever, but that's just not, we don't live in an ideal world. And the people who are on the other side of the channel at any point can close the channel on you. And that's where the software in the future will automatically kind of figure out, okay, this person has this actuarial, you know, expectation of closing a channel. So we're not going to open a channel with them because they're unreliable. We're going to find someone who almost never closes channels on others. So that might be like the way that the software optimizes to avoid that kind of situation. But I just want to reiterate, like, this will all be automated so that the end user does not have to worry about it himself or herself.
But you could get, if you're dealing with a malicious counterparty, to take recourse, you might have to do an on-chain transaction.
Yeah, so if the person in the channel decides to breach, so that is they broadcast an old channel state, or they're just offline and thus tying up your liquidity in a kind of an inactive channel because they're offline, then yeah, you are kind of forced into a situation where, well, with the breach transaction, they've already broadcasted an on-chain transaction. So you have to go and punish them, and then you get all the funds from the channel. So in that situation of punishing a malicious person, you actually profit off of that, assuming you're online. If you were offline, then you lose the money. But in the case of someone who is just unresponsive and is kind of a useless peer on the network, then you do have to close channels. What I would be worried about isn't so much like an individual having this problem. If we have kind of a network-wide issue where, for example, right now there's a player called LN Big, and they've been opening up hundreds of channels with different peers on the network. So if they were to go offline, or if they were to suddenly decide they're going to force close all the channels on everyone, then that would be disruptive to the network, right? And so that, I think that network-wide issues like that are a bigger concern in my mind than a local problem, because someone generally, like, you should have like 8 channels open with different peers, so that if one goes down, then you're still resilient for sending payments on Lightning.
This is why I'm actually, not to second guess Jack Mallers, who knows a lot more about Lightning than me, but this is why I'm a little hesitant to say that users will always transact on Lightning. Like these situations where you need on-chain recourse are likely vanishingly rare, you know, because the attackers can basically be punished. But you still, to protect your interests, you still need to be able to transact on chain under certain circumstances.
Right. And so the channels maintain a reserve balance for making an on-chain transaction. So, and the peers are constantly renegotiating that reserve balance. And what I noticed with the latest fee spike was that if someone had a channel open that was for 50,000 Satoshis, the reserve kept growing until like it took up the whole channel. So we kind of have to watch out for that as well, where if we have to open channels that are large enough to justify having a larger reserve that is for kind of the fallback mechanism of falling back on chain.
So one of the things that stands out to me in my kind of my world of looking at everything as dumb as I can is that in the simple world of Bitcoin, you know, I have a wallet. If I have to make a payment to somebody, I put their addressing, set the amount, and, you know, I put low, medium, high with my, say, price, and it sends, and at some point in the next, you know, hour or two, it confirms. It's very simple, and it's very easy to understand. In the world of Lightning now, in my limited exposure, there's so many other things I have to think about that I don't have to think about with Bitcoin. I have to think about channels and channel capacity and what happens if it gets closed. It feels very, very complex. And does that concern you at all? Because for me, I think it's putting me off using Lightning.
In my view, the complexity is partly due to the newness. It's hard and unfamiliar to us to think about payments this way, as, you know, essentially a bandwidth that can be consumed. I think, you know, partly you're epistemically very comfortable with Bitcoin itself because you understand it very well. So you don't really think about, SHA-256 when you're transacting. You know, you fully grokked the system and, you know, you don't have to worry about the minutiae. With Lightning, certainly is more complex, but, you know, I think about Lightning in terms of just as a deferred settlement system, which is one of the basic primitives of finance, is just achieving efficiency through deferred settlement with counterparties that you might trust a little bit more. And, you know, I don't really worry about all the complexity. And I would say that's the challenge to the developers, is to abstract it away a little bit. But certainly it's new to most of us, and hence maybe more challenging.
So these complexities are really just building blocks to a future final easier solution, as probably Bitcoin was probably very complex in the first few years and it's got itself to a point where it's really easy to understand. Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Of course it was. Yeah, I mean, you know, compare the difference between using Square's Cash App, you know, to get Bitcoin to the way you had to get it in the early days. And, you know, you had to run your own node and et cetera. I mean, I still recommend running a node, but acquiring and using Bitcoin was way more complex and required, you know, much more sophistication back in 2010.
Yeah, and I mean, I still hear people complain about addresses being like random numbers and letters instead of like having an email address or something like that. So like people, there's still concerns about Bitcoin's base layer UX. And then on kind of the way that payments are done on Bitcoin, like that's not great either from the merchant's perspective. Like when I worked at BitPay, like overpayments and underpayments and payments that were late essentially, and people were trying to game the exchange rate and all of that, like those were problems, and those problems are largely solved with Lightning's invoicing system. So I think that there's UX gains in with Lightning as well, aside from just the cool experience of seeing a payment instantly get confirmed.
The other thing is that we can afford to indulge in some more complexity because we're progressing in this layered way. So I think it's important that the base layer system is fairly simple, but we can experiment and try, you know, really complex features on Lightning because the costs of failure are less. If Lightning fails, Bitcoin itself is totally intact.
Pierre, how much can you tell me about how the fees in Lightning work? And there's been a lot of talk about the need perhaps for mega hubs. Can you talk to me about that and explain how that works and what the risks are and what the fears are?
Yeah, sure. So if you have a channel open directly with the person that you're sending money to, then you don't pay any Lightning routing fee, but you do pay an on-chain transaction fee to open that channel and then eventually to close it. The problem with doing that is that now you have to open a channel with every single person that you're sending money to. That's not very useful. So Lightning allows you to route payments where you can be connected to a node, and then that node is connected to the person who's receiving the money. And you're able to use them to route your payment, and they charge you a routing fee for that service. And they actually can set that fee themselves. So that means, and it's also publicly advertised. So if you open up 8 different channels, that means that you have 8 potentially different routes to get to someone else, which means that you can pick whoever is advertising the lowest fee and be able to send the payment that way. So that means that like this should be a fairly competitive market. Now, the advantage of having centralized routing nodes is that then you're minimizing the number of hops. So if everyone is connected to one routing node, then everything's going to only be one hop, and there's only going to be one routing node charging fees. So that would be like very efficient. The problem with that is that it's not very resilient. If that one routing node goes down, then the whole network essentially falls apart because no one can route any payments to anyone else. So what we're seeing right now with like the current evolution of the Lightning Network topology is that we're in between those two extremes. And so there are big routing nodes that are emerging, but at the same time, most people are connected to many different nodes. So it's not like those big routing nodes have some kind of outsized economic influence or are a big risk to the network if they were to go down. Now, what I think we'll see with the routing fees is that right now, it's a very inefficient market. There's very rudimentary tools for managing, like, what should my routing fees on channels be? And then also, like, how do I rebalance things so that I continue to route efficiently as capacity gets depleted in certain directions? So, like, all of these things that really, they need to be automated. Like, there's a massive amount of work to be done there. And so to me, Lightning is still very much in the Stone Age, but we have a very, like, I can see the horizon and I can see like what we can do imminently with the existing technology. And there's just a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built up around that. Now, I was just talking about the routing fees, but I think that actually a bigger source of fee revenue or fee cost, depending on which end you're on, so far has been about getting inbound capacity. So ideally, you would just get inbound capacity for free because other nodes are randomly connecting to you. But that actually takes quite a long time because the current iteration of Autopilot has this model called preferential attachment, where it'll preferentially attach to larger nodes and then also attach to smaller nodes. And so that means that like the larger nodes are accruing more and more channels, and it can take a little bit of time if you're a smaller node to just get inbound capacity for free randomly from other peers. So services have emerged where if you need to receive payments or you want to be routing payments and you need inbound capacity, you can go and pay someone to open a channel with you and provide that inbound capacity. So there's BitRefill's Thor product that does that. Lightning Loop does it in a like trustless atomic manner with one on-chain transaction. And we can get into like how that their product works, called Loop. And then I have lightningpowerusers.com, of course, which is my website where you can buy that inbound capacity as well. So I think that we'll continue to see like new pain points where there's like an opportunity for some people to make money, and it's going to cost other people money. Like in this case, it costs merchants money because merchants have to go pay someone to provide inbound capacity to their node so that they can be, you know, shipping orders and receiving payments. So eventually, like what I'd like to see is for there to be a protocol level marketplace essentially for capacity, where we can have a decentralized exchange for inbound capacity, but we'll see how realistic that is.
And another thing, Pierre, I wanted to ask you about is obviously there's an on-chain fee when you open a channel. I guess for you to benefit from the low cost of using the Lightning Network, you've got to hit a certain number of transactions for that to become economically worthwhile. Because if you're opening a channel just to send a single transaction, unless you need a fast transaction, there's no real benefit, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So it really has to be the case that you plan on reusing this repeatedly. Otherwise, it's like getting a rechargeable battery and throwing it away after the first use. Yeah.
Are the fees going to be high enough within the network to make it economical for these mega hubs to be out there providing capacity?
Well, we don't know if like we have no idea of knowing, really. I think that there's different theories about whether it's going to be hyper competitive, where the revenue is going to be like, you know, very small, or it's going to be like a loss leader where people are running a routing node, but they're providing other services that are ancillary to that, that benefit from having access to a routing node. And that's where they make money. Or that routing is actually going to be profitable specifically for people who specialize in it and actually have skill about like essentially being a trader, right? Where they are trying to figure out, all right, where is there a high demand for capacity on the network? Let me connect to a node in that area of the network. And then I know that, you know, I'll connect to a node in this opposite side of the network or whatever it is. And then I'll be able to route lots of payments. So there's like different views on how profitable that's going to be. And then on a macro level, if, you know, we were talking about the trade-off between on-chain and off-chain. So the point at which it makes more sense to send a payment off-chain versus sending an on-chain transaction, like that equilibrium is going to constantly be changing. And so we'll see as on-chain fees go up, will that cause routing fees to go up? Where essentially now a routing node is saying, well, the cost of me opening and closing channels went up, so now I have to pass that cost on to people who are using my routing node, and so I'm going to charge higher routing fees. So I think that's definitely a plausible scenario. But we just have to see it in practice and run the experiment.
So it feels like everything is just very exploratory. We're still very early. We actually need to see how people are using Lightning and seeing how it kind of handles the pressure and the stress of lots of people on it, so that either those who are running these mega nodes can see what the economics are for themselves, but also for developers to react and prioritize developments that improve the experience.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that if you talk with the developers, it's interesting. Like, they see their job as making it so that it's not profitable to run a big routing node, because that introduces this issue of centralization, right? Where now this network is not as decentralized as we wanted it to be. And it kind of plays into the hands of the critics of the Lightning Network.
Right, okay. All right, well, listen, this has been great. It's been useful. I'm trying not to, because I'm doing so many interviews this month, I'm trying to not leave them too long. Is there anything either of you want to add? And also, just as a final question, Is there any parts of it, of the Lightning Network, you have larger concerns about? And go to you first, Nick.
No, the main thing I'm worried about is actually just expectations management. You know, there's always a curious divergence between the very cautionary things that the actual developers working on Lightning will say about the its ability to, mainstream itself, and absorb a huge amount of capacity and work well for everyone, even, unsophisticated users. And there's a contrast there between what they say and then between what just, boosters essentially say, And there is a really significant risk, I would say, which is the risk of, Bitcoiners or outsiders becoming disappointed by the pace of progress there. And, I think people like Christian Decker do a really good service when they bridge that gap, and they'll qualify the pace of development and make it clear what the constraints are. And that, Lightning is maybe not a silver bullet to solve all of Bitcoin's problems, and that's fine because that was never the expectation. But if that is the expectation, then it becomes kind of a crisis for Bitcoin. And in part, the block size wars were due to super inflated expectations about what base layer Bitcoin could do. And then the delta between those expectations and reality. And it's not that the reality was wrong, it's that the expectations are too high. And I've seen a little bit of this on Lightning, it being presented as this, final solution to all of Bitcoin's issues. And I think it's a really vital piece of the puzzle and a really sophisticated network, which is way beyond its years already in terms of the amount of adoption it's getting. But, I think it's also worth just recalling that Bitcoin itself works fine. If Lightning doesn't grow to the desired size, that's not fatal to Bitcoin. And, we're not necessarily indexing our hopes for Bitcoin on Lightning, although I think Lightning is the most promising development in Bitcoin right now. So that's my note of caution.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I found the best way to manage people's expectations is to just have them use it. And so that's why I created the Node Launcher. And so if you want to try out Lightning and see if let reality set your expectations instead of Twitter, then that way you can see what the promise is, which is people who have been able to send payments are raving about it, and then what some of the pitfalls are. I do get lots of support requests from people who are having technical difficulties with using the Lightning Network. And so to me, there's no better way of adjusting people's expectations than sticking their nose in it. And so I'd highly encourage people who are curious about it to not spend too much time reading about it and actually go use it and then read about it. that way you can have a taste of where it currently stands. So I've written a Medium post. The Medium post, actually, I just edited it. I deleted 2/3 of it because it has gotten so much simpler with new versions of the Node Launcher. So definitely go check that out. And then I guess my closing thought would just be that I do think that having a system, whether it's Lightning or something like it, where you create a lot of demand for on-chain transactions and inelastic demand, where essentially there's no substitution effect if on-chain transaction fees go up, where people are going to start using Litecoin instead. So having inelastic demand for block space, I think, is going to be key to driving up transaction fees to a level where they are providing suitable transaction finality, and we don't end up in double spending hell when the block subsidy have an increasing amount.
I mean, my kind of summary is that it's just super early. If anything, it's still a bit of a toy. It's a bit of a plaything. I think you have to have a certain amount of knowledge and you have to have a certain amount of experience. I don't think it's a commercially ready technology for the masses yet, because there's too many complexities around using it. That's my experience so far. But at the same time, the handful of times I have used it, it's been mainly a pleasure and I haven't really had any problems. I don't think it's a smooth journey from the Bitcoin base chain to using Lightning just yet.
No, and many earth-shaking technologies start off looking like toys.
Yep.
The reason I think people are so excited about Lightning in spite of some of the UX difficulties of using it, is because it speaks to the layered scaling approach on Bitcoin. And it, so far, it's proven itself to work, which, you know, for the longest time was just, it was just a far off, deeply held belief and hope, but it wasn't a reality. So the fact that in, you know, these last few years, we've come from, you know, discussions on mailing lists to a paper and then a specification, and now, you know, many complete competing viable implementations, that is pretty astonishing. And it reflects a maturity of thought within Bitcoin land that we have conceded that we can't just open that block space throttle indefinitely. And, you know, we're now in the process of building out this overlay network, which makes Bitcoin true to maybe some of the early visions for what it would be. And that is extremely exciting and important.
I think that, like, Bitcoin as an investment and as something that people buy, like, to speculate on, is going to have much faster and has had, you know, arguably mainstream adoption, like with the Cash App or with Robinhood or, and I think that's going to continue, and that's going to, like, move much further ahead than Lightning will. And I think that, like, there's always going to be, like, Lightning's never going to be finished, so it's always going to be getting improved. And it might be, like, a few years before, I would say, you know, Lightning is ready for mainstream, per se, of someone just downloading an app on their phone and using it. But, like, that's okay, because Bitcoin itself is also not really mainstream, even though, like, the news talks about it all the time, but there aren't, it's not like all 300 million Americans are using Bitcoin.
All right. Well, listen, look, appreciate both of your time as ever. It's very useful for me to put some of my dumb questions to you. So thank you both for coming on again.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Was that a helpful interview? It definitely was for me. I went into the interview with all these questions and concerns and possibly, if I'm honest, criticisms. But a few things started to fall into place during the interview. Firstly, when Nick talked about expectation management, me as a UX person, when I'm looking at Lightning and using it, I'm kind of treating it like a finished product, which is probably unfair because we are super early with this. There are so many things being worked on and things being figured out. And as people have said, look, this is reckless time. This is essentially a beta. It's time to get in there, play, move some money around, see what happens. And then the devs can learn from this and they know what to build on to make the experience better or kind of fix things that maybe don't work in the way that people expect. One great point is that if you compare the experience of buying Bitcoin with the Cash App now to, say, with Bitcoin in 2010, the experience now is infinitely better because things have developed. The Bitcoin ecosystem has grown. New technology has been developed. And essentially, Lightning's kind of in the same place, right? It is a new technology. It is this new second layer on top of Bitcoin that we've not really had before. So I'm starting to understand that this is about building the building blocks themselves. You know, start with the basics of Lightning, let people play with it, and the future building blocks will come into place to improve the experience. So Lightning will probably look very different in a year and then in 3 years and 5 years. And probably the best thing now is to have a little bit of patience, a little bit of trust in the dev. So that was really useful to me. Also, it's really useful to me to understand that actually a lot of the discussions about or criticism with Lightning potentially come from people who are opponents to it. So they're looking for a problem. They're looking to jump on it when there are people who are aware of things that maybe don't work in the right way and are aware of the future dev plan. And because of that, I've actually agreed with Christian Decker that he's going to come back on. We're going to do another interview next week, like Christian Decker 2, Lightning Month, where I'm going to expand with him on those technologies that he's talked about that are coming, that people are working on to improve Lightning. So yes, I hope you enjoyed the interview. It was definitely useful for me. I definitely came out of it with a different perspective or a different feeling about the status of Lightning. And as ever, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I can't be bothered to go and do all the bits that tell you how you can help support the show. It's late. I just want to get this one out. So listen, if you do, just head over to my website. It's whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. That will explain everything. Lots more interviews come in. I'm going to be banging these out over the next couple of weeks. Feel free to reach out to me if you've got any ideas, you've got any suggestions. My email is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I can't wait to hear from you.